morning, and welcome to Family Life. Your host, Salima Muhammad and Dr. Nadia Muhammad. Dr. Muhammad will join us at the end of the month. This program is sponsored by New Africa Excellence, Zarab Speaks. It's me, Allah, Rahman, and Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful. I greet my guests and the listening audience in the peace of Assalamu alaikum. This week's discussion, family life, we have the honored guest, Mr. Doe. Mr. Doe is the co-founder, board member, and communications director, Hoodie Books, LLC, the world's most intelligent clothing, and the Human Advancement Movement, a New Jersey-based nonprofit. Through these two educational organizations, he works to spread the benefits of literacy and lifelong reading to children everywhere. Before launching Hoodie Books, the THAM in 2019 and 2020, respectfully, Mr. Doe pursued several unique career avenues. Mr. Doe's early life pursuits as a commercial seaman and fisherman in Alaska. He worked for a company called All Alaskan Seafood Operations. He led and was in charge of the depth of operations for Alaskan operations specifically. In addition, worked on the king crab fishing vessel, the Elizabeth F. He worked in areas such as Dutch Harbor, Port Lions, Kodiak, Bristol, May, and the Bering Sea. And this is during the time of the 70s and the 80s. He received a certificate and Master Deckman certification. His time as a bail enforcement agent began in the early 80s when he founded a group called the Seekers. They operated out of New Jersey and captured a record number of felons, 200 plus, from around the country. Under Mr. Doe's leadership, the Seekers follow a set of spiritual mandates and procedures that at the time baffled mainstream law enforcement. Besides firearms and physical training, the Seekers read books as a mandatory daily ritual, addressing higher philosophical thought, reading, and meditation were a significant part of their daily workout regimen. The Seekers received full media coverage from major television outlets, newspapers, and magazines in the United States of America and parts of Europe. In 1999, Mr. Doe authored The Seekers, a bounty hunter story with Anthony Bruno. It was published in 2000 by HarperCollins and was nominated for the Edgar Allan Poe Award in 2001. For the best nonfiction book. Studios, in fact, continue to send Mr. Doe offers to make a film based on The Seekers book. Mr. Doe also held a private detective license between the years of 1985 and 2008. During that period, he conducted forensic research and investigations for clients. also provided in personal protection to various groups and individuals from the entertainment industry and private corporations. He served as head security consultant on two major films, Boomerang, starring Eddie Murphy, and Disappearing Act, starring Wesley Snipes. Mr. Doe changed track again, receiving a grant from a personal friend in 2009. This time, he researched and developed strategies helping people fight wrongful home foreclosure actions. He overturned a 10-year standing New Jersey Superior Court Chancery decision at the New Jersey Appellate Court in March of 2018. Case involved senior citizen rights pursuant to the foreclosure of reverse mortgages. Mr. Doe's full-time investigation of the residential foreclosure crisis in America led to the criterion of Informer and Associates, PE. That's Informer and Associates. He remains a researcher and strategist at Informer to this day. He is currently devoting his efforts to presenting the Hoodie Books products and Young Scholar Reading Incentive Program to schools in New Jersey and the marketplace. Mr. Zoll, what a pleasure. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's clearly a pleasure for me as well.
So let's get right to it.
Okay.
We're living in unprecedented times, and we're going to talk about foreclosure crisis. We're going to go right to the subject, the expertise that you have spent over a decade researching. Please give us a little background of the case mentioned earlier, especially involving the senior citizens and the reverse mortgages. In fact, before you start, I have heard so many people in the community when one spouse dies, so we're speaking of a couple, and one spouse passes away. Now, in that original or initial agreement, that reverse mortgage is not to occur until the second spouse passes away. However, banks have initiated claims against surviving spouses to foreclose on their home. Can you give us the background of that case and this subject matter, please?
Okay, well, it all starts out basically, as I've said earlier, the documents that we signed. We have placed an enormous amount of trust and faith in the legal community, particularly at closing, to guide us through the minefield of the world of the covenants. And what I'm speaking about basically is that these notes and mortgages are not contracts. They are, in fact, covenants. And since they are covenants, they are pledges, which sort of travels one way. That's you pledging everything to them and them pledging very limited things to you. In the case in New Jersey here with the reverse mortgages, the banks were claiming, or this one particular bank they saw was claiming, that the reverse mortgages were not protected by the Fair Foreclosure Act here in New Jersey, and that upon death, they could immediately file for a foreclosure and just move to take the property. So what was established was in that case was that they were violating the law. And just because this word reverse mortgage was used instead of a regular mortgage did not change the context or the content that it was a residential mortgage. And still, the homeowners and the heirs had the protection of the Fair Foreclosure Act, which that case established. So it pretty much stopped them from just filing claims against the surviving spouse or heirs of the property. It stopped them from filing instant cases like they were doing. They now have to serve the notice. They have to find someone who's an heir or entitled to the properties to start negotiations with and to before they could actually file a foreclosure complaint.
Very important. Let's go and speak about and describe specifically what housejacking is.
Housejacking is really wrongful foreclosure. It's when banks are using documents that are not truthful, that are very deceptive in their language, and they're moving the courts to actually take the property based upon that deception. So housejacking is when one is wrongfully foreclosed on successfully by a mortgage servicer or some form of a trust or some other entity that has lied in its certifications to the case.
Now, earlier you said, so I want to go back to the case that you were able to win in the New Jersey Appellate Court. Here's why. And tell the audience what that the case scenario was and how long it took and why it took so long, but what you were able to achieve at the end, please.
Well, you know, at the end, I'm going to stop at the end. I really, at that particular point in time of the end of the case, had a conversation with one of my elders, and it wasn't so much about the inherited house that was left to me. I was more motivated by the fact that they were doing what they were doing to senior citizens. That was the motivating factor to me, that they could actually know that someone had passed away and move quickly to get the other surviving spouse or other party out of the property. That was our motivating factor. So to have the court reverse the lower court decision that reverse mortgages were exempt from the protection. And this is what the judge was claiming, that that the property was exempt from the protection because it was a reverse mortgage was, to me, the thing to focus on, and I had to get the decision reversed on that principle alone. And that's what happened. The appellate court looked at the plain language in the law and stated, for the most part, that the plain language is what they were ruling upon and that reverse mortgages were not isolated from protection of the Fair Foreclosure Act. And that is when the decision was based upon. That's what the ruling was based upon.
So essentially the dichotomy in the court system was we're going to essentially hijack this home based on superficial or non-existent law is what was exactly happening, correct?
Yeah, well, the judge actually attempted, and I was able to have him render on the record to read the plain language, and he inserted his own opinion at the end of the language.
Mm-hmm.
And so I questioned him on that. I have the same rule book you have, and that last part you uttered was not in the rule book. And he said, well, I'm going to stand by what I said. And I said, okay, I'm going to appeal your decision. But this happens all the time. You know, this is really all about language more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
We have not really as a community have taken the time to slow down to read the things that we are saying, because there's a psychological drama that's going on also where we want the thing so bad, the house, whatever it is, student loan, whatever, we want it so bad that we shut down a part of our thinking when we execute these covenants. We have to slow down. And because we were warned about covenanting with certain folks in certain ways. And these documents, again, I must say, are not contracts. They are covenants. And covenants, the definition of a covenant is a debt covenant are restrictions that lenders, creditors, debt holders, and investors put on lending agreements to limit the actions of the borrower. That's what a debt covenant is.
And they don't have it.
Yeah, they don't have it. They put it right there in our face. But again, the psychological drama of getting the house and moving in, putting the furniture where you want, fixing it up and having a home, it supersedes our ability to stop and see exactly what we are signing.
Now, case scenario, I just purchased a home. What is the first thing I need to do before the closing? Should I get documents shipped to me ahead of time? Because, you know, at the closing, sometimes it's 60 to 100 pages there. How would you recommend, again, that's probably a format to limit the knowledge of the borrower? How do we do this differently? Please.
We first begin to qualify the attorney who's going to be doing attorney review. We've made broad assumptions and unexamined habits and customs have us believe that just because I'm dealing with an attorney, he should automatically know what these documents represent. So we must first, if we're going to use an attorney, qualify that attorney by asking them certain strategic questions to see if his knowledge is in that subject matter. If we're going to do it ourselves, then we must ask for those documents to be sent to us way in advance and truly take the time to read it, get a highlighter, get your favorite cup of tea, and sit there and understand what you're about to pledge yourself to for the next 30 years. I want to say that again. What you are about to pledge yourself to for the next 30 years.
Mm.
That is what we must do. Qualify the attorney and understand what we're putting out John Hancock in before we do it.
Very important. So that first procedure, qualify the attorney. This is your closing attorney. And you're right, because they come from various backgrounds. Some of them know certain things. Some of them do not have certain knowledge bases. The complexity of this whole process really starts with who's the expert. And you're telling us right now that we need to be the expert or we need to have expert eyes on these contracts.
Yeah, the attorney walks away. You know, he gets his closing fee and he's gone. You're the one who's stuck with the 30 years of obligation. And today, with today's mortgage market, which is really, it's called the originate-to-distribute model. You know, back in the day, way back in the day, the note and the mortgage used to stay together at all times. But somehow Wall Street has come up with a way to create these loans and then sell them almost immediately and then turn them into mortgage-backed securities for even more money.
Mm-hmm.
And that has changed the mortgage market like you could not believe. I mean, people, these mortgages change like insane because it's hard to keep track of a regulated mortgage transaction that's changing from hand to hand to hand, going from one trust to one service to another service. Many of these services have different platforms that they do their accounting with. Most don't have internal accounting departments. So you can't call the services and ask them if there's something wrong with the numbers. They use outside third-party vending companies that have set up algorithms, and most of this accounting is being done in the clouds. There's no human being there to attest to the accuracy and the truthfulness and the correctfulness of the accounting that's being done with these mortgages anymore. Most of these mortgages are being handled in the clouds.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's another problem. The closing attorney has never been in the interest of the borrower, but are they in the interest of the lender?
I think they're just in their interest to make money, because if they truly examined the subject matter, then I could truthfully say that they would know what side to pick. But most that I have encountered just want to get the closing done, get their payment, and move to the next proposal. They're not interested in understanding the subject matter the way they should. That's not a put down on the attorney. It's one of my best friends.
I understand. I'm just trying to give the listening audience, you know, some of the characteristics of the players, and you're absolutely correct. That is not, you know, a derogatory statement towards that profession, but you have to know why they're employed in their platform. And the more you know, the more you understand. I totally understand where you're coming from. Let's talk about some of the programs that exist today and what happens when you enter these agreements. So let's start off with forbearance, okay? Not particularly a favorite of mine, because at the end, but it can be used as a tool, but at the end of that forbearance, those funds that are behind are due. Now, we have some options. After the forbearance, we can go into a modification, and some aspects of that modification can serve as a partial claim. But let's talk about the forbearance as a tool and some of the areas where fraud can come about.
Well, it's almost impossible to actually be in midstream and actually determine the correctness of the fraud if you don't start from the beginning. Because the fraud in the transaction doesn't start in midstream, it started at the closing table.
Mm-hmm.
Now, forbearance means the action of refraining from exercising a legal right, especially enforcing the payment of a debt. I always start by saying, who has the right to either initiate forbearance and who is the actual owner of that debt? Because the government states that the only one that would have right under that covenant that you sign is the note holder. But yet, we are negotiating with mortgage services, sub-services, securitization services, and all these other entities where we should be possibly directing our attention to who's actually the owner of that loan/account.
Mm-hmm.
So forbearance basically says, I'm going to back away from you and I'm going to exercise my right to allow you time until we can reengage.
Mm-hmm.
But you always should start with who's the owner of that, who you thought, before you begin to start negotiating forbearance. Who owns it?
Now listen, this is good, but at the negotiating table, that closing attorney, you're going back to that closing attorney, you closed on the house, ABC Bank is the bank to whom I purchased the house under. The Sunshine Bank is the bank that it sold to. Now I enter a challenge where I'm having difficulty due to the pandemic, whatever the case may be, because I lost my job of making payments. Sunshine Bank is not the original bank. How do we find out who's the owner of the debt, the true owner of the debt, and where should we begin?
Glad you asked that. That is where phase one of some of the deception starts. We have accustomed and led to believe that the loan was sold when another bank arrived. Start out with the loan originator, and then months later, year later, whatever, there's a new entity that pops up. Say, I'm now servicing your loan. Well, the only thing that was sold was the servicing rights, and that's the right to collect the payments, to work out the issues with escrow, property preservation. The mortgage servicer has limited rights. He's like the guy who takes care of your grass. He comes by every so often, he cuts it and makes it, cuts it, everything down, makes everything nice. He's not the owner, so that entity is not the owner of the obligation, which is the promissory note obligation. They're just servicing it. So there's a constant change of these services cause more confusion because unless you, again, are able to determine if the servicer is collecting proceeds for the actual owner of it, of the debt or the promissory note covenant that you signed, you really don't know how those payments are truly being applied. The monthly statements that you get each month, I'd ask, and I still do when I'm corresponding with them, are the numbers coming from the mortgage servicer on the monthly statement, or are those numbers coming from the owner of the debt?
Mm-hmm.
See, now, am I looking at numbers that have been calculated by the servicer or by the owner of the debt? The best way to find out who the owner is to issue a qualified written request to the mortgage servicer requesting the name and address of the owner of the note.
Mm-hmm.
That is the best way to get that information.
So let me ask you this. And this just brings up another question with regard to who lent the money. Now, and I'm speaking specifically of the FHA government and or commercial private lenders. Are they the owners?
FHA and Fannie and Guinea and Freddie don't lend money. They are a conduit for the creation of securities that flow to investors, certificate holders, and trusts. So they're there just saying, we guarantee that if anything were to happen, we'll use the full faith and credit of the government to correct it. But they don't lend money directly at all. And when we go to the closing table, we sometimes don't realize that we have more power than we think.
Mm-hmm.
The value is the fact that one will produce revenue for an entity for 30 years to pay on a debt that has not been validated. And what am I saying? How many people ask the question you just asked? where was the source of the funds to fund the loan? Where did it come from? Because it doesn't come from the loan originator, and it doesn't come from the mortgage company.
So let's go back. Let's go back and get a little bit more clarity. Why does it matter who the owner of the debt is?
Well, that is the basis of the claim. That is why you pay. We've been led to believe that we have to pay our mortgage. But in fact, if you read the mortgage covenant says, refer to the promissory note covenant, because that is the holder and owner of that is who's owed the payments, not the mortgage holder, but the note holder. So technically, we are paying the promissory note, not the mortgage. That is a misnomer. That has been something, that's another bad custom that we believe that, oh, I got to pay my mortgage. No, you're not paying a mortgage. You're paying on that note. And whoever holds that note in transfer or negotiation is the one supposedly entitled to it. And I said supposedly.
Yes. Yeah. Now, how does a situation, and this is happening to a friend, and it was just interesting. Folks scour through legal, publicized legal information to find out who owns a particular property. Now listen to this. This is the strangest of any resolved fine, but this is the strangest situation I have ever heard yet. There was no issues with the mortgage. The mortgage was being paid on time every month. But a gentleman contacted the mortgage company who those funds was being sent to and stated that he was a private investor. And there was no private investor. This was all a farce. It was not true. But sent some documents that he, as a private investor, he was going to impose a juncture where he either gets a percentage of his investment or initiate a foreclosure claim. So it was some type of fraud, and the person brought it to my attention. I said, first thing you need to do is go to the mortgage company, look at your paperwork to find out if there's any documentation in the legal aspect of this case. Of course there was not, and they were able to, you know, resolve the situation fine. So how does entities create fraud and send paperwork for individuals to sign and they have no legal obligation to the loan? Have you ever heard of these type of incidents?
Well, you know, that I've heard worse.
And
the problem really is that the homeowners have not been instructed on how to create a master file. And what am I saying? When you, people reach out to me to help them or to discuss their issue, I always ask them, do you have all of your documents together? From the origins of the loan, do you have them? And most people don't. They find that, you know, they have some documents here, they have some over here, they have some documents over here, and they say, oh, by the way, I remember receiving something that was sent changing the loan from one entity to another, but, you know, we need to create master files for these properties. So we have everything
yes.
in a chronological order.
Yes.
So we can go back through the timeline to see how things are being changed either correctly or fraudulently. This master file process is key to maintaining control over your 30-year application. It is key. You must be organized. You
I agree with that.
You everything in a chronological order.
Oh, my gosh, that is so important. That is.
You must keep everything that comes to you in the mail and take nothing lightly. I received something probably 6 months ago, and I've seen thousands of documents. And I received something from a private member who had received a package after we sent them a strategic QWR that I'd never seen before. And I thought I had seen everything possible, but there's one document that came from from the bank, signed by the executive vice president, was a game changer for me, a total game changer. It shed more light on the transaction. That one-page document shed more light regarding this mortgage and this residential home buying transaction than anything I've seen in 13 years. It's one page. And so I said, keep everything.
Mm-hmm.
Get yourself some binders. Put it mm-hmm. in a chronological order.
Mm-hmm.
So when we, and it makes it easier for a competent attorney to also represent you because he has everything there in binders that he can chronologically see what has occurred with your transaction. So that strategy for madness, it really is a strengthening tool for homeowners when they need to defend their property.
Excellent. Yes, that master file is so key. So when negotiating various financial options to correct the past due forbearance deficiency, how does one approach and evaluate the best options based on who owns the loan?
First, you must find who owns the loan. And then once they identify that owner, then you do the due diligence to find out if that owner still exists. We have found
mm-hmm.
where they have identified trust
mm-hmm.
as the owner of the debt. And after doing a Security and Exchange Commission search, doing Bloomberg, Standard & Poor's, and doing the searches for these entities, we have found that many of them no longer existed. So the question is, if the mortgage servicer is collecting money for a trust that no longer exists, where is the money going? Where is it going? Were they paid off through insurance? Has the debt been discharged in some other offset procedure or process under the Uniform Commercial Code? What is the tenant?
And when I find that out, what do I do?
Oh, you bring it to their attention. If you are to an entity that no longer exists, how does that work? Please put that in writing and send it to me.
Oh.
How does that work? You're collecting a debt for an entity that no longer exists. How does that work? How does that work?
I see where you're going with this.
Yeah. Please advise. You always have them put things in writing. You can get on the phone with your services. You can talk to your attorney Blue. But the best strategy is to say, please put that in writing and send it to me. And, oh, by the way, have someone who's duly authorized to sign it.
Okay, so now let's go there for a second. Is that your loss mitigation area or is it not of the servicer?
They will have departments, and I don't know whether they create these departments on a fly or do they truly exist. when they get a question, customer service agent doesn't see an answer to on his screen, the file gets bumped up to another department.
Mm-hmm.
And the higher the department you go through, the better chances you have of resolving it. Why? Because you're making it too complex for them.
Mm-hmm.
And you're digging too deep. What they don't like is when you're asking strategic questions and asking them to sign their response before back to you.
So what mechanism is available to the borrower once you find all this out?
It's to communicate to the servicer. They have to make the corrections.
Oh.
If they are servicing it, they must correct it. Or you take it up with the owner if the owner still exists.
Okay, what happens if the owner, as you stated earlier, doesn't exist? What happens?
Let's think about it for a second. If a mortgage servicing company is collecting a debt that they claim was given to them to service under a pooling and service agreement or some other type of agreement such as that, then how can they legally collect payments for non-clients?
That's what I wanted to hear. Yes, yes, yes. We're looking at the legal aspects of this clearly.
Yeah, how can you do it? How can you collect for an entity that no longer exists? You can't.
Let's talk about some of the guidelines you explained and depicted perfectly where fraud begins. So I'm just going to reiterate. You described the difference between the covenant versus the contract. Now, are there any real contracts in closing? And if so, how do they come into existence? And again, this is something we're researching before we actually close. But how do we make those determinations, you know, at that closing table? As you stated earlier, you stated that we need to understand what's going on there. And if we don't understand, we need to have a third-party real estate attorney who does need to understand. Now, how important is it for us to depict the difference between the covenant versus the contract? Does the contract really exist?
This covenants are a convenient way to do something that may be lawful but not legal.
Uh-huh.
But if you agree to the arrangement through a covenant, and if I haven't seen very many promissory notes and mortgages that was signed by a duly authorized representative of the bank, signing, you know, at the same time as normally just the homeowner and a notary or an attorney attesting to the signature of the buyer, the borrower, which again cancels it from being the contract because it's, I'm lending you $100,000, you can trust it. We're going to have a contract, and my name is going to be contract, but under a covenant, which is a pledge, you are the only one pledging everything, and they can perform in certain kinds of ways, whether they be disclosed or undisclosed. The key to it all is, like we spoke earlier, is about really taking the time to be informed about what these covenants really mean. What the terms of the covenants really mean. They're not long documents at all,
mm-hmm.
but they're very, very deceptively written. The language is, it took them a while to create this custom. And this custom we're grown to see as being normal before getting the house, not what's bounding us down for the next 30 years in the form of debt.
Mm-hmm.
We have to separate our emotion from this transaction. Let's forget about the house for a second. Let's just concentrate on what these covenants are saying, so we can go into these deals with a lot more knowledge and even possibly a lot more, a better negotiating position.
Yes, yes, sir.
If you know what they are and you see where they have made some assertions in the documents that may not be true, that might be a more powerful negotiating point for you to reduce interests and principles and everything else. So the first thing, again, I can't say it enough, is to understand these covenants that we assign.
And especially when it comes to the reverse mortgage. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. To the listening audience, this show is brought to you by New Africa Excellence, Rod Speaks. So let's talk about some of the cool the tools. And we think, I'm thinking ahead, and we think, oh, my God, some of these tools are cool, but they can really have us end up losing our home. So let's talk about forbearance and what we want to identify the owner of the note or any type of negotiation before we start. Explain what the second silent mortgage is and where the borrower may not be required to pay back the modification funds. Can you explain what that is? What are the tools?
Yeah. Until we fully examine for us the language in it, the documents, and I've seen different variations of these so-called tools to help the homeowner. I've had most recently a mortgage servicer who was giving someone a modification, a document that they actually put themselves down as the lender in the modification agreement. So I stopped them and said, wait a minute, what consideration did you pay modification agreement? Because you're listing yourself as a lender. So what offsheet, dollar signet, or double entry ledger or certification can you send to me showing the consideration you paid to be a lender on this modification agreement? And they couldn't, because it was just a custom for them to do this kind of stuff. So now if they modified it from its original, we are now attempting yet again that this entity is a lender in the relationship without proving consideration. Without putting up or showing or making appear in the document consideration. Because in order to be a lender, you must show consideration. Like, this is what I gave. This is what we paid. This is what we did to offset the agreement. So it goes back to, again, we have to look at the language in these tools, because what I've seen, they're not tools to help us. They're tools to confuse us even more and to stake more of a claim. Now, I'm going to say something right now that I don't think people will get mad at me, but it's an observation that when we talk about home ownership, what we're talking about in reality, position that we have in a piece of real estate. Well, ownership is something totally different. Because ownership must be expressed in writing. And I don't know too many people that can pull out their documents and show expressly that language. We have an equity interest in the house. And technically, that's all we have. That's why we can get an equity law line against it. In regards to ownership of the land and the house itself and these other things, I don't think that exists anymore. We have an equity interest in the real estate that we're living in. And that's what we have. One of the gentlemen who I met in Washington State, who was a retired banker, said to me, and this was back in 2000, economics is warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And don't you forget it. I said, what do you mean? He said, it's warfare. Economics is warfare. And that war is fought through the documents that's being conveyed to transfer what we assume is ownership for what they see as strictly equity.
Mm-hmm.
Strictly equity. We develop a romantic relationship with our homes. It's an emotional thing. But to them, it's just equity. This is equity.
So let me go back, and I think I'm understanding this better, and correct me if I'm wrong. I just want to reiterate what you're saying, because I think I'm understanding this as we go along, and I am representing the listening audience who may have questions. So if I'm in a forbearance, and we discuss this, the first thing I want to do before negotiating the tools for that, of which we just discussed some of the tools, I first want to determine, and to me this is very clear, very important, who the owner is of the debt. Okay.
There you go.
So, that's the first thing I want to do. If the debt doesn't exist, then I'm going to challenge that debt being owed legally. Correct?
Correct.
Okay. How about if the debt does exist, and then the mortgage company only gives you a certain perimeters of program, you're going to go back to FHA to work within. How do I proceed? What's the best program for me? Do I put that forbearance on at the end of my loan? Do I come up with the second salary mortgage? Because I don't want to pay this back. Or if I do pay it back, I want it to be honest. So if I only owe that servicer $10,000, I don't want to have fees adding up to $78,000. How do I protect myself? First of all, I'm not signing the document.
Right. That's right.
Until I understand what's going on.
Sit around in these offices to crunch numbers for homeowner paperwork. It costs too much money. if you can shift it to some kind of platform and module that would actually do it automated in the clouds. So, and the answer to the question is you ask them for the accounting, if it's proprietary, or do they have a vendor that they're using to crunch the numbers? And then, again, most importantly, is you find that that owner of that debt. Another thing that's important about these tools or how to apply these tools to these new mortgage originate to distribute model transactions is that when you are able to look at your documents, one should ask the question, if there's a trust involved in my loan, how did my regulated mortgage transaction turn into a mortgage of that security transaction? And there's no language in those primary documents that bind me that says that, you know, my loan could be changed from a regulated, a heavily regulated mortgage transaction to a non-regulated mortgage-backed security transaction. The reason I bring that up is because U.S. Bank years ago was saying that, and these different trustees were saying that the homeowner had nothing to do with the mortgage-backed security transactions, that even though the notes were being transformed into a security, that the homeowner had nothing to do with that transaction. Well, there was a pretty tough judge in New York who kind of put the screws to U.S. Bank and made them admit to the point that where they actually put it in their brochure that speaks about the distinct party roles in a mortgage-backed transaction. And they openly says that parties involved in an MBS transaction include the borrower, the originator, the servicer, and the trustee, each with their own distinct roles, responsibilities, and limitations. Now, why is that powerful? Because if you engage in a mortgage-backed security transaction, and that transaction could not exist without your signature on the primary documents that created that mortgage-backed security, then what benefits are you getting from this relationship? What trade-offs? What offset are you getting from being engaged in a mortgage-backed security? Because it wouldn't exist without you.
Let me go back to the, let me go back, because I have a specific question. And to the listening audience, we are going to continue this with Mr. Zoe next week. He has agreed, because the subject matter is so vast, we want the listening audience to have necessary information so we can do what Mr. Doe advised in the beginning. We need to pause and we need to slow down. I have a specific question. You know, this tool came out with regard to reverse mortgages. Now, years ago, Mr. Zell, you just tell me if this currently exists and how homeowners can find out about this. Many borrowers invested in insurance, not only life insurance, additional mortgage protection insurance. And I went online a few months ago, and I didn't see this mortgage protection insurance anymore. And this is where, if a party passes away, we're not talking about the tool of reverse mortgage, but if a party passes away of that couple owning the home, passes away, that mortgage is paid for in full. These mortgage protection insurance policies used to exist. Do they exist anymore?
Absolutely. that's all part of what we're speaking about. It's the fact that just because it doesn't appear doesn't mean it doesn't exist. We have to seek out those kind of policies now. Maybe it's common for the common person to automatically to get. So if you seek it out, you could find it. It still exists because insurance companies, you know, they want those proceeds, but because of the major mortgage and sell model and how they've changed the whole mortgage industry over, that certain insurance companies, I would probably say, have deemed that it would be best to not make that those kind of policies openly discussed.
Of course not.
Right.
I mean, you should be more. And so, what do you say to the person who's completing their doctorate degree, who has children, who's working full time, and they don't have time to do all of this research? Because let me explain to you, this is a process. Where do they
Well, really, you begin by actually communicating with someone who's blazed the trail or someone who has blazed the trail. There's no reason why we individually all have to blaze that trail if others have blazed that trail. So it's just a matter of getting in contact with someone who has really done that mid at all and has not just theorized the strategies but have actually used them in and out of the arena. I used to run into people who would theorize about these different concepts about mortgage protection and all this other kind of stuff, but you have to be tested. And like we said about the attorneys, you have to qualify individuals whether or not they have really done the due diligence. A lot of people have good intent, but, you know, based upon where we are now, in this climate, good intentions are good when you're making an apple pie, but when it comes to defending, you know, where you stay and your home and your investment, it's best to qualify individuals and really make sure. So we don't have to create the wheel all over again. There are many trailblazers for us in the past on different subjects that we're now quite informed on, and so we don't have to squeeze it there. We just have to make contact with the right people. We can make contact with the right people that we can get the information. And
can you hear me? It's because you cut off, Mr. Zoe. Can are you still with us, Mr. Zoe? Are you still with us? It seems like you cut off in the midst of your statement. And this is fine, because he left us with so much information. And just reviewing something, he will be on, to the listening audience, he will be on again next week. The procedures to understanding our mortgages. Hold on, let me see if I can bring him in. Hold on here. Let me see if I can bring him in. We did lose him. So this is fine. He will be on again next week. I was just going to see if I can bring him back in. The first thing we want to do is to determine who owns the mortgage. We're just going to review. So pause, slow down, find out if the mortgage, if the existence of the owner is valid. If it is not valid, that homeowner should then file a claim to dispute the legality of who the funds are owed to. If it is, we do find the owner of a particular mortgage, then we're going to proceed with the various tools that may or may not benefit you. It is a good place to stop and start next week to re-review what we've discussed in detail today. Some of the tools we discussed was forbearance. He specifically stated to create a master file, which is key because your organization then becomes imperative so that you can defend the accounting of a given claim. So again, very, very important. Insurances to cover mortgage upon death, that's where we're going to end. And he said these mortgage protection policies do currently exist. We'll speak more about this next week because you want options. You know, the reverse mortgage seems like an attractive tool, but you want someone to inherit that, especially if your home is owned. Very important to be able to make these discerning factors to protect your investment, not only for yourself, but for the legacy of your loved ones. Since we lost Mr. Doe, we will rejoin again next week because this is imperative information for our community. If you need to contact me, you can do so at Salima, M-O-H, 77, at gmail.com. Thank you so much for joining us today. This program is sponsored by New Africa Excellent. Mirad Speaks. Please join us again next week where we will have Mr. Zoe on the call again to share this very important information about home ownership, foreclosures, and some of the tools that are offered to us to prevent us losing our homes. Again, thank you. This program is sponsored by New Africa Excellent. Mirad Speaks. Have a great day. As-salamu alaykum.